It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Last week, the U.S. Supreme Court commenced its latest term, a term during which the High Court will take on some of the country's most controversial topics, including cases having to do with abortion access and gun rights. And these high-profile cases come at a time of growing concern over how politicized the court seems to Americans. We'll talk about polls later in the hour. This hour, we have two members of the University of Iowa College of Law faculty to walk us through several of the cases in this especially historic term to give us their thoughts as well. Emily Hughes is Associate Dean for Academic Affairs and a law professor at the University of Iowa College of Law. Hello, Emily.
Hi, nice to be with you.
Nice to be with you. And Derek Muller is with us as well, professor of law at the University of Iowa College of Law. Derek, welcome back to our program.
Well, thanks for having me.
And we want to invite our listeners to join our conversation on any of the cases we talk about, or perhaps you have general questions about Supreme Court things you've heard in the news, questions, concerns about the U.S. Supreme Court and how it works, and any of these high-profile cases. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. So we have a 6-3 conservative court, a court that last heard arguments in person more than 18 months ago. It was the coronavirus pandemic, of course, driving the justices from their courtroom and the court hearing arguments by telephone. This term, the public remains barred from the courtroom. The courtroom will continue to provide live audio of its arguments. Before we dig into these cases, Emily and Derek, give us your thoughts on the significance of this term. Emily.
Well, certainly we've got a lot of cases in the queue here that are really interesting to hear, and we're all interested to think about the composition of the court and being back in person. So it's an exciting and big term.
Derek?
Yeah, I think, last year, because of the election, because of a lot of late-breaking changes that were litigated before the Supreme Court and brought to the Supreme Court, in many respects, it was a much faster-paced term. So I think we might see a little bit slower this term as things sort of return to normal. And otherwise, yeah, it's wait and see what they'll do with some of these big cases.
Okay, let's start with what is being recognized as the biggest case among these very significant cases, Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization. Derek, will you take us to the origins of this case and tell the story here?
Sure. So Mississippi enacted a statute, essentially almost totally banned abortion beginning 15 weeks into the gestational period. So this was sort of a direct attack by the state of Mississippi to address the issue of Roe versus Wade. So beginning with Roe in 1973 and then Planned Parenthood versus Casey in 1992, the Supreme Court ultimately established a rule that basically said there's a constitutional right to abortion, but the state has a legitimate interest in protecting potential life, and that includes the ability to protect the fetus after viability. And so today we can think about that as 22, 23, 24 weeks. There's some different views about that. But pre-viability, before viability, the thought is that the state can't place restrictions that place an undue burden on the ability to seek an abortion. And so a rule like Mississippi's, which essentially prohibits abortion after 15 weeks, with an exception for fetal abnormalities or the health of the mother, extreme medical emergencies, subject to very narrow circumstances, it would prohibit abortion. And so this comes up to the Supreme Court essentially as a direct test to Roe versus Wade.
Mm-hmm. The arguments will be heard slated for December 1st of this year. Derek, what do you anticipate as the arguments on each side?
Right. So, the Supreme Court, of course, doesn't have to take cases. It makes a choice for the most part about whether it wants to take a case. And this was a case where the lower court had said, Mississippi statute is unconstitutional. So the fact that the Supreme Court is interested in hearing it, I think, is significant in its own right. Mm-hmm. For those who are defending the law, they say, look, Roe was wrong when it was decided. the Constitution places no right to abortion anywhere in the Constitution. It's something that judges created in the 1970s, and this should be instead left to the political process. And so you're going to see a lot of that talking about what the Constitution's original meaning meant. On the flip side, I think respondents are saying, look, this is, you know, this is long established precedent. You can't go and undo 50 years of precedent. And in particular, one thing that the court is supposed to do when they consider precedent is consider reliance. That is, have people organized their affairs or their lives around an expectation that the court has described what the law is? And I think you will see a heavy emphasis from those who are supporting abortion rights to identify, you know, the longstanding precedential practice and warning the court not to, to change what has been settled in some respects, at least from the court's perspective, for 50 years.
Mm-hmm. Are there, in the long history of the Supreme Court, are there other precedents that have been around this long, so firmly embedded over generations that have been overturned?
Well, I mean, you can, you know, more controversially, you know, there would be things about racial discrimination, you know, where the Supreme Court affirmed certain kinds of racial discriminatory practices in the late 19th century and then overturned them later on in cases like Brown versus Board of Education. The Supreme Court recently overturned a case like Korematsu versus United States, which involved the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. Only to overturn that decision a couple of years ago. So there's no question that there are cases that are old. Again, those are both racial discrimination cases. So it's something different in kind, where the court does revisit those issues. But you know, I think the political nature of abortion also makes it one of those hot topics for this court to consider right now.
Indeed. Derek, how does this case relate to the decision on that Texas law that we've been hearing about so much in the news?
Yeah, so the Texas law has a lot of procedural wrinkles. Let's just put it this way, right? Mississippi's is much more of a straightforward regulation of abortion, which many states have been doing or attempting to do ever since Planned Parenthood versus Casey. Texas's was a solution designed to essentially avoid litigation, to make it difficult for a plaintiff to challenge a law. It also began at it restricts abortion at 6 weeks as opposed to 15 weeks, unlike Mississippi's law. So Texas's law, you know, has a whole bunch of procedural problems that are being litigated in the lower courts and are taking much longer to resolve. So I think the extent of Texas's law plus the complexity of how the law was set up have really lent to a lot of the media attention you've seen of it in the last several weeks.
Mm-hmm. Emily, jump in here. Give me your thoughts on this case.
Well, just bouncing off the what you were just saying about Texas, I think one of the interesting things about the Texas law is who can bring the action. So Texas really widened the pool of people who can, you know, potentially sue, and that makes it really different as well.
Mm-hmm. So when we talk about what they could decide, the arguments to be held on December 1st, and typically the Supreme Court waits with its most controversial cases until, well, late spring or early summer. Derek, what scenarios are possible here? How many scenarios are possible, and what would they be?
There's dozens of scenarios. I mean, I think, you know, one is the court says we're just going to kind of keep the status quo. Planned Parenthood versus Casey set this undue burden standard. This places an undue burden on the right to seek an abortion prior to viability. Therefore, the law, you know, is unconstitutional. Another more extreme would be Roe versus Wade is wrongly decided. We are throwing it out. Abortion is now a political question left to the states, and each state is going to approach abortion in a different way. And maybe a more moderate middle ground, depending on what the court does, is to say, well, we're revisiting Casey, and we're not sure that, you know, Roe versus Wade should be thrown out, but at least this Mississippi law, you know, it provides some exceptions up through 15 weeks, that some restrictions prior to viability are okay. The state has justified them here, and the law is upheld. So it could undermine Roe and Casey while upholding the law, but not fully throwing it out and sort of punting the question for a later day.
In overturning Roe v. Wade completely, we know, Derek, don't we, that certain states, Republican states, dominated states, have so-called trigger laws that will immediately act upon this Supreme Court decision.
Yeah, there are some, you know, abortion statutes in other states that, you know, have been put on hold because of Roe or judicial holdings. There are other statutes that won't go into effect unless Roe versus Wade is overturned. And that's a sort of a patchwork quilt across the United States, right? In some places, abortion rights will be greatly protected. In places like Massachusetts and New York, in other places, they will, you know, not have very much protection at all. And laws, you know, like those in Texas might come into play to allow pretty significant restrictions.
If you just joined us, we're talking with Derek Muller and Emily Hughes. They are on the faculty of the University of Iowa College of Law. They're walking us through some of the most significant cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. The High Court's latest term began just last week. Emily, we heard in our news at the top of the hour that this today is the running of the Boston Marathon, and we are talking about a case that has to do with the Boston Marathon, the bombing of the marathon it was back in 2013. Is that correct? I think
that's right. April of 2013.
Yeah. Tell us what this case is about.
Right. So to take us back to April of 2013, although I'm sure listeners remember well, that was when three people were killed and hundreds were injured. Saranov and his brother, although his brother died before he could be charged, were alleged to have been responsible for setting off bombs near the finish line of the Boston Marathon. So Mr. Saranov was charged with a capital crime, so a death penalty crime, and convicted and sentenced to death. And then it went up on appeal, and the death conviction was reversed. So the idea being, go back down and you get a new trial just on the sentencing phase, not on the whole trial, but on the sentencing phase. So the court on Wednesday is going to hear two questions before it to basically decide whether or not to reinstate the death penalty or whether to let it go back down to have a new sentencing on the death penalty.
Mm-hmm. So this happened in Massachusetts, in Boston, but the crime is that he was convicted of a federal crime. So that's why we can have the death penalty?
That's right. That's right. And the two issues in front of the court, you'll have wide ranging consequences. So they're not just confined to the Boston Marathon case. So the two issues in front of the court, one has to do with jury selection, and it has to do with jury selection in high profile media cases. So arguably, it doesn't get more high profile than all the coverage that went on with the Boston Marathon case, especially because they were not, you know, caught immediately. So there was, everybody will remember, extended coverage trying to locate them and find them before they were actually arrested. So the issue with the media coverage is during jury selection, the defense attorneys representing the defendant wanted to ask jurors about specific media coverage that they had seen. So, you know, what did you specifically see? And the judge shut that down. Now, the judge did allow questions about generally, you know, did you hear about the case? But getting into specifics was not allowed. So that's the first question in front of the United States Supreme Court.
Yeah, why would that be problematic to ask about specific reports that they've heard? Seems like a logical question.
Right. So, well, it part of it has to do with the judge has discretion to set the boundaries of jury selection. And there was an extensive jury questionnaire and there was questioning of jurors. So the question just becomes, where do you draw the line? You know, how long do you let this go on? And the defense would agree with your question, right? They would say this is important, and even if it takes a lot longer, we need to be able to ask this because we need to know whether jurors can be fair and impartial on this case, given specifically what they saw about the case.
Mm-hmm. And there was a second aspect you wanted to get into here.
Right, and the second aspect had to do with the sentencing phase of the capital case. So in a death penalty case, there's basically two trials within the trial. The first part of the trial is the guilt or innocence of someone. You know, did this person do the bombings that killed people? And then once the jury determines, yes, in fact, this person did do, you know, is guilty of first degree murder, then it moves on to essentially a totally new trial, a second trial, which is the sentencing phase. And at the sentencing phase, the question before the jury is, should this person be sentenced to death because of it? And the jury determines that. So there's more evidence that's put on in the sentencing phase. It's like another trial. There's opening arguments, there's closing arguments. And at the second phase of the trial, the defense theory was, do not sentence him to death. You know, he'll spend the rest of his life in prison, no possibility of parole, but do not sentence him to death because his older brother, who died during the capture of the brothers, but the older brother was the ringleader, and he was the younger brother following the older brother. So the older brother was more culpable, and, you know, you should sentence him to life in prison without the possibility of parole, but not death. So in support of that theory that the older brother was the ringleader, essentially, the defense wanted to put on evidence of three prior murders that the older brother had been involved in. And the judge did not allow that evidence to be in front of the jury. So the second question in front of the United States Supreme Court is, was that the right call? Or did the defense have a right to let the jury hear that in order to support their theory, which was the older brother was the ringleader?
Emily, what do you see as implications depending on how the court decides here?
Well, there's interesting implications, both for the media coverage aspect. It really does go to the heart of how you handle high-profile media cases and jury selection. So that has implications, you know, outside of the death penalty, even arguably. And then the second part of it, it goes to the heart of what a defendant is allowed to put on at the sentencing phase of a capital case. You know, what kind of evidence do they get to put on? And arguably, it doesn't get more core than what their theory of the defense is. So it has some pretty wide-reaching implications.
Emily Hughes is a professor, law professor at the University of Iowa College of Law, together with Derek Muller, also professor of law at the College of Law. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer. We're having these two walk us through some of the most significant cases before the U.S. Supreme Court in a term that began last week. One of the very high-profile cases, as we've had, I don't know, give us some background here, Derek. I don't know when the last time gun rights were had reached the Supreme Court. This involves a case that has a say about the rights in carrying a gun in public, at home, as opposed to at home. What is this about?
Sure. So the Supreme Court had a couple of major Second Amendment decisions years ago, District of Columbia versus Heller and McDonald versus City of Chicago. And those both involved sort of the construction of the Supreme Court looking at the Second Amendment, saying there's a right to bear arms, right to bear arms in your home to protect yourself, because both D.C. and Chicago had very strict gun control laws. And since then, you're right, Ben, the Supreme Court hasn't really weighed in on a lot of gun regulation ever since. A lot of lower court decisions have upheld rules barring felons from carrying handguns, from magazine capacity restrictions and things like that. But this case comes out of New York, and litigants have been trying to bring a challenge like this for some time, where New York requires a license to carry a gun outside of your home, a concealed carry permit. It includes a caveat that you have to have proper cause. And a couple of challengers were denied the right to carry a handgun. And so they're suing to say, you know, we should have the right to bear arms outside of our home for self-defense. While Heller and McDonald were about sort of self-defense in the home, the thought is really that when the Constitution speaks of the right to keep and bear arms, the bearing arms requires the ability to protect yourself outside of your house, outside of the home, as you enter public.
Mm-hmm. And so the Constitution, you pretty much quoted the significant phrase there. So it's not clear from the Constitution. This is a matter of interpretation, whether the founders decided that right to bear arms was something in home or outside of the home.
Yeah, so I think, you know, a major part of it will be sort of again, a majority of this court really cares about the original public meaning of the Constitution, about what the framers thought about the right to bear arms in public outside the home, to carry it for self-defense and personal protection and preservation. The respondents on the flip side, states like New York, are saying, look, there is the ability to regulate within reason, right? A well-regulated militia is a portion of that statute. And the court had said in Heller, you know, there are some longstanding existing kinds of regulations that could withstand scrutiny. And so it is really a battle of the Second Amendment's meaning. What kinds of things does it require as a matter of right? And what things does it allow the state to regulate in order to protect the public?
So right now, would it be fair to say that we have a patchwork of different states' laws that do this? And this has the potential of what, should it be decided in favor of expanding gun rights?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, many states have fairly generous concealed carry laws. Not all do. Obviously, states like New York don't. But they at least allow it with a permit. And in a handful of states, it's very difficult to get a concealed carry license at all. And so the Supreme Court's decision here, if it sets the contours about those circumstances in which states can restrict your ability to take a gun outside of your house, could dramatically affect what gun rights look like in those states that have the most restrictive laws. But you're right, otherwise it's a patchwork sort of framework about which states have the most generous ones and which ones have the most restrictive ones.
Mm-hmm. We have about a minute before we go to break, but any thoughts on how this court, this conservative court, will decide this?
Derek? I mean, I think people have pointed to some opinions of, you know, then Judge Brett Kavanaugh and then Judge Amy Coney Barrett when they were on the district courts about signaling some favorability towards Second Amendment rights and gun rights. So I think there is some thought that the court is going to be friendlier to Second Amendment claims than they might have been in the past. But otherwise, it's wait and see.
Okay. Talking about the New York State Rifle and Pistol Association, Inc. v. Bruhn. That's the name of that case. Derek Mueller talking about that, walking us through it along with other cases. And Emily Hughes is on board, two faculty members at the University of Iowa College of Law. That case will be heard on November 3rd, considering the constitutionality of a New York law imposing strict limits on carrying guns outside the home. When we come back, we'll walk through some more cases and then also get to the point, ask our guests about those very low popularity or opinions of the high court in the minds of Americans. When we return, if you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Back with Emily Hughes and Derek Mueller of the University of Iowa College of Law. I'm Ben Kiefer. Stay tuned.
Iowa Public Radio has the cure for your endless scrolling, the IPR app. The latest news, your favorite music, fresh podcasts, they're all a tap or two away. With newscasts updating throughout the day, the latest stories every time you open the app, and live streams of your go-to station, you get only what you need to know when you need to know it. So stop the scroll. Get the IPR app.
And we're back with this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, together with Derek Mueller and Emily Hughes of the University of Iowa College of Law. Both of them are professors at the UI College of Law, from where they join us today. We're having them talk about some of the most significant cases before the U.S. Supreme Court in its term that began last week. In just a few moments, after we talk about a few more cases, we'll talk about the sinking public approval rating of the Supreme Court, dropping significantly. One poll taken by Gallup last month found only 40% of Americans approved of the job the court was doing, and that is the lowest rate since 2000, when Gallup first posed that question. But Derek and Emily, let's continue talking about some of the cases that you have put on our docket for this show to highlight. Emily, what's another case that you have your eyes on?
Well, I have my eyes on a case that was argued the very first day that the court heard arguments last week, and it's Wooden versus United States. It has to do with a couple different issues. One is Fourth Amendment rights, the right to sort of be safe in your home. And then it also has to do with interpretation of a federal statute that could significantly increase how much time a person spends in prison.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what's at the heart of these cases? Tell us a little more.
So Mr. Wooden was in his home about 1 a.m, and the police were looking not for him, but they were looking for a fugitive that they thought was staying in his house. Mm-hmm. The reason they thought this fugitive was in his house is they'd seen the car parked outside the house before. So 1 a.m, the police in plain clothes, knock on the door and ask to speak not with Mr. Wooden, but with his wife. And Wooden, after he answers the door and they say, and they don't identify themselves as police, say, can we talk to your wife? He says, just a minute. He does not invite the police in, turns around, leaves the door just a little bit ajar, grabs something from behind the door and starts walking back. And the police walk into the home at that point, see him carrying what they think is a gun, and everything kind of unfolds from there. Essentially, he gets charged in the end with felon in possession of a gun. And because the court interprets, and this is what we're going to get into, that he had been a felon, but based on 3 prior criminal offenses, the whole sentence gets increased to a minimum of 15 years up until life. So the sentence gets increased significantly based on the court's interpretation that he had 3 prior felony convictions. And that's where things start getting pretty interesting, too.
What was the object, in fact, a firearm?
It was. So yes, it appeared that he was carrying a rifle, and then whether he's carrying that one or they find it back in his bedroom later, but there definitely is a gun, and he is a felon. So there's no question he's a felon in possession of a gun if the police had a right to be inside of his home. So that's the first question in front of the court is, mm-hmm. Was it this warrantless entry and then search of him? What did that violate his Fourth Amendment rights? Because he never said, you can come in my house. He said, just a minute, I'm going to go, get my wife. And then they walked in without a warrant and without arguably a right to be there. He was originally charged in state court, and the state court basically said, Fourth Amendment violation. And then he gets charged federally, that's the issue. The first issue is whether or not the federal court was right in finding there was no Fourth Amendment violation. But the other issue has to do with the sentence.
Yeah. Yeah.
The sentence. And so that one's interesting because to get increased to a minimum of 15 years, there have to be 3 previous convictions. And one of the convictions they counted multiple times. And I'll tell you why. It's because he was charged and convicted of burglarizing a mini storage facility years before, right? This is years before. And he had broken into 10 different mini storage facilities. So he was charged with 10 different counts of burglary for each one of the storage facilities, and he pled guilty to those and, was sentenced, and that was all done. But the court, in sentencing him on this new thing and saying you've got 3 priors, counted those as multiple prior convictions. And rather than just being essentially one time, but 10 different incidents, counted them as 10 different convictions. And the government says that was right to do. And, his attorney says that was wrong to do because the language of the statute says you can only count those 3 prior convictions if they were committed on occasions different from one another. So that's the key language, occasions different from one another. And his argument is, sure, I broke into 10 prior storage units, but it was all the same occasion. It's all the same night, right? Versus, having 3 prior convictions based on 3 prior things.
Emily, do you have a sense of how this may be decided? with this court?
Well, it's really interesting because it was the first, you know, argued on the first day. We got to hear, we know some of the questions that were asked. And Justice Thomas asked a really interesting question, which was, you know, I hear your argument that it's all the same occasion, but when do we get to start counting it as separate occasions? So, for example, if he's in the middle of breaking into the storage facility, and this is what Justice Thomas asked, and he goes to Dunkin' Donuts for a little coffee break, or he goes out and just takes a smoke break and then goes back in again, is that still the same occasion, or is it now separate occasions because he took a break in the middle? So there were a lot of questions having to do with, you know, do you judge this by time? Do you judge it by the same episode? Some of the justices were really interested in thinking about it as one episode. And so it's a little hard to tell based on the questions that they asked, but it will certainly have far-reaching implications for people charged with federal offenses, because the difference between 15 years and the regular sentence is a lot.
Emily Hughes, along with Derek Mueller of the University of Iowa College of Law, with us this hour. If you just joined us, talking about some of the most significant cases before the on the current term of the U.S. Supreme Court. Derek, before we get into some other conversations, talk about a case that has to do with the so-called separation of church and state. Walk us through this case.
Yeah, so the case is Carson versus Macon. It involves schools in Maine. So Maine has some very rural districts where it's difficult to provide education for everyone there from the public school system. And Maine allows you as a student to use a voucher to go to a private school. But they say the student can't use the voucher for a religiously affiliated school. And so this is ultimately challenged in the state of Maine. And it comes on the heels of you know, I won't bore the listeners with too many details, but it comes on the heels of the court really grappling with a long sort of series of cases, trying to figure out where this overlap is between the state entangling itself in religion, as it's described, because the Constitution forbids a legislature from endorsing a religion or establishing a religion. Some of it's constitutional language, some of it's the court's gloss. And the flip side, the ability to engage in the free exercise of religion, that the state can't abridge that ability if you're trying to practice your religion. So in a couple of recent cases, the court has been reluctant when the state makes distinctions between religious and non-religious institutions. Several years ago, when the state of Missouri told a Lutheran preschool it was ineligible to apply to replace gravel on its playground with recycled tires as a new soft pavement, the Supreme Court said, you can't do that. You can't just say you're a Lutheran preschool, you're ineligible to receive the funds. And it had similarly last term in a case called Espinoza out of Montana, where Montana had said you can't give state support to religious institutions, only to secular schools. The court said you can't just draw a line sort of forbidding the opportunity for religious institutions to seek out opportunities that the state is making available to everybody else, essentially kind of an equal protection kind of claim. That is, religious institutions should be treated just like everybody else. And so Carson versus Macon is kind of the next in this series of cases about asking about what kinds of distinctions the state can make in treating religious and non-religious institutions differently.
And given the cases you just mentioned, the prior cases, does that lead you to conclude that this may be concluded in favor of this religious school?
Well, you know, the recycled tires on the playground got a much broader support from a majority on the court, right? Justice Breyer, I think, wrote separately to emphasize, look, I mean, we're not paying for the pews in the church. We're paying for playground equipment, right? But this is a very tricky thing for the court to wrap its mind around, right? Are you paying for educational instruction, in which case there's a religious component to it? Or is this fundamentally about a religious use? That is, that it's something that that shouldn't be resulting in the state entangling itself with religion. And this entanglement language, you know, they've referred to a couple times, has long vexed the lower courts. It's long vexed litigants to think about how much is too much. And so I think there's a really good chance that the court kind of steps in and says, you know, maybe we've been using some language that has been unhelpful and offer some greater clarity. And in the process, I think, you know, we can think about it as a school issue, but you know, it might extend to more situations where the court has drawn lines between religious and non-religious institutions, saying you shouldn't do that. You should treat them the same.
Mm-hmm. Emily, I think we have time for you to walk us through one more criminal case, I believe you have there to tell us about.
Sure. This is another defense theory of the case. So we were talking about that earlier with the Boston Marathon case, and this is Hemphill versus New York, which was argued last week. It has to do with Hemphill was charged with a murder, and essentially there was a street fight in the Bronx. People left, people came back, and then very sadly, a child in a minivan got caught in the crossfire and died. And two people were charged with that crime, not Hemphill. So the two people that were charged were different people. And the first one that was charged basically said, let me cut you a deal. I'm going to tell you who else was involved and implicate somebody named Morris. So again, not Hemphill, right? And Morris, the state of New York, tries to prosecute these first two, mm-hmm. and is pretty unsuccessful against Morris. And so they basically come back against Morris and say, how about we cut you a plea deal? And it's that plea deal that they cut with Morris that finds its way into Hemphill's case. So I haven't mentioned Hemphill at all, right? How he gets implicated in this is that the first two basically say eventually that Hemphill was involved and was the shooter. And Hemphill, again, defense theory of the case is kind of the unifying theme here. He says, I didn't do this. It was the other two, right? I wasn't even there. And so his theory is it's these other two. I wasn't there. I'm not part of it. And when he makes that his defense theory of the case, the state of New York says that they get to use the statement that Morris made at his plea, basically talking about what kind of gun he had used to undercut Hemphill's theory. Now, why this is significant is because Hemphill doesn't get to cross-examine Morris. Like the right of confrontation, this critical constitutional right, doesn't happen. There's no cross-examination. This evidence comes in by way of this paper plea deal. And so Hemphill says, this violates my rights as, Sixth Amendment confrontation clause. I get to cross-examine him. So that's really what's at stake in this case. A pretty, when somebody has a third party defense, right, essentially saying these other people did it, not me, does the defendant open the door to allow the state to bring in this testimonial evidence, this paper evidence, essentially, undercutting their theory of the defense?
Okay. An important case, obviously very nuanced and complicated, one to keep our eyes on. Let's talk a little bit, going away from the cases in the final few minutes of the program, get your views on what we've been seeing in public opinion about the Supreme Court. As I mentioned a few moments ago, that public opinion, according to Gallup, taking a beating there. One poll taken last month, finding that only 40% of Americans approved of the job the court was doing, the lowest rate since 2000. We have to remember that this poll took place following this spate of unusual late-night summer rulings. We had that Texas ruling. We also had a conservative majority on this case rejecting the Biden administration's policies on asylum and evictions. Derek, you first. What do you make of this all-time low, at least in a Gallup poll, of the Supreme Court?
I think it's telling. You know, you mentioned 2000. That was Bush versus Gore, and probably a low point in terms of the court's reputation. And so sometimes it goes down, and sometimes it comes back up. But recently, you know, there's no question that especially Democrats in Congress have really made criticism of the Supreme Court a very public and visible thing. And so I think we're seeing that more and more play out in public sentiment. President Biden has convened a special panel of dozens of constitutional law and Supreme Court experts to consider the future of the court. So there's no question, I think, that the public is not only aware of the decisions that are hotly contested and controversial, but that also many in Washington are making it an issue, which is, I think, raising it in the minds of many more people than in recent years.
Mm-hmm. How much does this matter, the public opinion about the court, Emily? Considering that the Supreme Court doesn't have an army, it doesn't have an enforcement arm, the authority from the Supreme Court comes from where, if not from public confidence? And if that public confidence goes down, doesn't that really set off some alarm bells?
Well, I do think it's important. And, you know, our country stands on the rule of law. And so people respecting the rule of law is critical. I do think on a positive side, even though, as you began the hour talking about the court is not allowing the public to come in right now because of the pandemic, but the court has taken some great strides in opening up and making a little bit more accessible what's going on. So in terms of broadcasting live arguments and allowing people to listen in real time, I think those are really positive strides that hopefully will increase, you know, I think the more transparent the court can be about the inner workings of the court, hopefully that'll help to increase public support.
Mm-hmm. In a series of public appearances, we've had several members of the high court, Breyer, but also Justice Barrett, going public. We had several remarks by Justice Barrett at the University of Louisville's McConnell Center. In fact, the Senator Mitch McConnell introduced her. She said during that public outing, "My goal today is to convince you that the court is not comprised of a bunch of partisan hacks." That was the quote, Derek. But how do you convince people that in such a partisan atmosphere that that's not the case? And also when we see that in major cases, it's fairly predictable how a justice, isn't it, how a justice will rule, will vote, so to speak, based on who appointed, whether it was a Republican or a Democrat, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, just to restate Emily's point, I mean, I think the court wants to do things with a public face to instill that confidence. I think there's a reason why lecturers like Justice Barrett's or Justice Breyer, who has a new book, are designed to do that. Maybe doesn't always persuade people. And I think there's also at least some sense that the court is aware of this reputation and it wants to put on the best face. But at the same time, these are hard questions. These are hard, contentious questions that come up in the most public place in the country, in public court, at least in the country. And for many years, the court has had its partisan divisions. It just sometimes they were maybe a little bit slipperier, or they moved because there were some more moderates on the court who could look more conservative on some issues and more liberal on other issues. So I think it's, in my judgment, it's a little bit of a wait and see about how this term plays out, what the holdings are, what the reasons are, and what the backlash is. I think the court is going to do its job, and it's aware of public perception. But at this end of the day, we want justices to make their decision based on the law and not just the public reaction to it.
Mm-hmm. Emily, comment on the role of the Chief Justice John Roberts here, and how that has changed with the addition of new justices.
Well, certainly the Chief Justice really prides himself on trying to unite the court. And I think he really sees that as his job and his fundamental duty. And so to the extent that he can pull the court together in as many near unanimous or unanimous decisions as possible, that's certainly what he's striving for. And I think in part because of what you're talking about, the public sentiment, the public wants, as Derek was just saying, to believe and to trust that the court is deciding cases based on the law and not based on politics, and respecting precedent, respecting the law that's come before, to the extent that it's still good law.
Mm-hmm. Derek, I wonder, in the classroom, a lot of questions from your lawyers in training about the politics of the court. Is that a concern?
Well, maybe I just run my classes a little bit differently. I mean, at least in evidence, Emily raised the question about the confrontation clause, and I'm sure I will discuss that with my students later in the term. And I think in constitutional law, it comes up when I teach federal courts. One of the things I open with is thinking about President Franklin Delano Roosevelt's proposal to sort of engage in court packing and the public reaction to that. And so it's certainly something that is historical and important for students to consider. Why do we want to change courts or change the jurisdiction of courts? And so they are engaged, at least in some of the classes, thinking about that in some fashion.
Okay. We've run out of time. Thank you very much, Derek Mueller, Professor of Law at the University of Iowa College of Law. Also, Emily Hughes, Professor of Law, in addition to Associate Dean for Academic Affairs. Emily and Derek, thank you so much for your insights this hour.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You already know you carry all of your favorite podcasts in your pocket, but did you know you can carry all of Iowa Public Radio too? Just tell your phone to play Iowa Public Radio, News, Studio One, or Classical, anytime for your favorite stream.
River to River Today, produced by Zachary Oren Smith, engineered by Jonathan Free. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.